Hey everyone, you're listening to the Happy Market Research Podcast. I'm Jamie Brazil, your host. We are joined today by Marco Vreens. He is the founder and CEO of Quantum. It's spelled with a K, K-W-A-N-T-U-M. He is also the author of From Data to Decisions and The Business of Marketing Research. Founded in 2017, Quantum Analytics is headquartered in the Silicon Valley and is a market research consultancy specializing in advanced analytics and AI. Prior to founding Quantum, Marco has served as the Global Chief Research Officer at Ipsos, Chief Research Officer at Miller Brown, VP and Managing Director of Knowledge Networks, just to name a few. Marco, it is an honor to have you on the podcast today.
Yeah, it's my honor, Jamie. Thank you.
You and I first met, I believe it was in Atlanta at MRMW. The topic I got to hear you present with Roher Verhulst from LinkedIn on the topic of how you're thinking about and using ChatGPT and AI more broadly to bring insights to life. Some really interesting stuff in that framework that you presented in the paper. I want to talk about that in just a little bit, but I wanted to pull back first. What are a few realistic potential applications of AI and what do those impact? So for example, you know, is it just better, faster, cheaper? And so kind of unpacking the question just a little bit more, AI has, for us as market researchers, AI has been this sort of thing that sits out there. I'll reference the blockchain, for example, this abstract construct. And we know that it has some additive value, but it's not been really accessible to the masses. Obviously, with ChatGPT, now everybody has access, like not just market researchers, but at a consumer level, right? You can be a high school student or junior high student working on a 2-page paper and all of a sudden have a specific application of using ChatGPT. So, you know, what I'm really interested here is all of a sudden we've moved from it's not accessible to it is accessible. And from your vantage point, what are you seeing as like something that's practical and a realistic potential application of AI and then the subsequent like impact that's going to have on us?
Yeah, that's quite a big question, Jamin. So let me just recap a little bit what I heard you say, right? You're interested in learning about practical applications of AI, but then you also, you know, mentioned ChatGPT. And ChatGPT is of course probably the most well-known, you know, AI model that's probably, you know, that people are talking about right now, right? Yeah. But of course the field of AI is quite a lot bigger than just than just ChatGPT. So if I frame it in the context of what you started out with, like faster, better, and we
probably should pause really quick there because that's an important distinction that you're making. So AI is this large umbrella term, and inside of it we have things like machine learning, for example, right? And then as you've just articulated, we also have ChatGPT that sits underneath that AI umbrella. So AI is really, to your point, it's this broad construct, and now there's a specific narrow framework of ChatGPT that fits there.
Yeah, and ChatGPT, as you probably know, right, and I would imagine many people who are listening to this podcast as well, ChatGPT is a language model that, you know, they call it a large language model because it learns from, you know, quite a huge amount of data. The model is based on, you know, billions of parameters. So, you know, that's quite unique and quite interesting in and of itself, but it is a language model. But there are also AI models that are, you know, that are basically using numerical data. There are AI models that are using visual data. So those things exist too. To come back to your initial framework, like, you know, faster, better, and cheaper, if you think about something like ChatGPT, obviously it allows people to do things faster and cheaper and maybe in some cases even better, right? If I put it in the context of marketing research and the context in which I have used it, but that's only one example, and I'm sure there are many others. I know that you can use ChatGPT, you know, to develop, you know, initial surveys. You can probably use ChatGPT to, you know, to write some R code for you or to translate R code from, you know, to Python code. Those are all applications that allow you to do things faster and probably cheaper. We have used at Quantum, we have used ChatGPT to actually generate full survey results based on actual survey questions. But instead of interviewing people, we are asking ChatGPT to come up with basically, you know, hypothetical respondents, but they're not 100% hypothetical because ChatGPT pulls that information from, you know, from all the online sources that, you know, that it is being trained on. And so that's an example where you can for sure do things cheaper because obviously survey research is extremely expensive and it's also in most cases extremely slow. And now by using ChatGPT, I can generate full survey results of, you know, hundreds of people, if I want to, thousands of people, in a matter of a couple of days, and you know, and maybe in the future even faster. And the only cost that I have to incur is that I have to have somebody that can write, you know, that can write the right prompts for me, you know, and basically generate that data. And that's of course way, way, way less expensive than, you know, than executing a survey. It is also way faster because I have the results in a couple of days instead of, like, you know, 6-7, you know, weeks to sometimes several months. So that's one example. Another example, which is not ChatGPT, and you and I talked about it at that Atlanta conference, is a technique called SMOT. And SMOT is a method that also allows you to generate, let's say, what they call synthetic data. So this is not data that's actually observed on a respondent, but it's created. In this case, it is created from existing respondents, but, you know, it's a new data point, and it's defined on all the survey variables that you have in your survey. But it can only be used when I already have, let's say, a sample, and that has some real practical and proven applications. You know, one application is, for example, in, you know, when you have classification models, when you have predictive classification models. For example, I want to predict whether people prefer brand A versus brand B, or I want to predict whether people are going to churn, yes or no. Now, when you have that type of situation, and you have a situation where that dependent variable is heavily skewed, which oftentimes is the case, then the traditional predictive models don't work very well, and sometimes they don't work at all. By using SMOT, I can now generate data for that minority class, and making dependent variable less skewed, and that makes a huge difference in terms of, like, how well the model works. And so this is very counterintuitive, because I'm using synthetic data that is in some ways not real because I'm making it up, but the results that I get from my analysis are actually better. Even though it's counterintuitive, this is extensively proven. There are many, many papers that have proven that this technique works very well. To come back for a second on the ChatGPT that we used for generating survey responses, not only is it cheaper and faster, but another application is that, and as you probably well know, and I would imagine many listeners as well, that in marketing research, there are certain audiences that are very hard to reach. You know, I do quite a lot of work in the business-to-business technology industry, where you oftentimes have to, you know, interview IT decision makers or, you know, IT people. These people are sometimes not easy to find, especially when I have to do large-scale tracking studies. And if I have even more specific screening criteria, it may even get more difficult. And so if I can't get enough respondents, then ChatGPT could be a strategy to augment the relatively low sample size because I just can't reach those people. And so it becomes a way of getting data on how to reach audiences in some way, right? Yeah, so these are examples where you can do things faster, you can do things better with SMOT, and you can do things cheaper with, you know, with ChatGPT.
Let's talk about SMOT for a minute. Can you spell it for me?
SMOT is spelled as S-M-O-T-E, and it stands for Synthetic Minority Oversampling Technique.
Perfect, SMOT. I'm a practical market researcher is how I've kind of framed my career. And I can tell you the last 20% of any sample frame usually takes 80% of the time. And it probably continues sort of in that framework. And you're looking at the last, you know, those like micro samples, those nested quotas, those really, really difficult subgroups. And I've oftentimes wondered when I'm dealing with sample providers, I'm not suggesting that they're lying or cheating or anything like that, but there is that, like, question in my mind, and I've, you know, seen it firsthand practically with some suppliers as well, of, you know, just frankly data that's been made up.
Yeah.
Because you've got to get out of field, right? I mean, there's time pressure and cost pressure, and you just can't spend another, you know, let's say you're in field for 2 weeks, you can't spend another 4 weeks getting 10 people. It just doesn't, it just doesn't make sense.
We just published a paper in Quirks magazine on data quality and how to manage it and how to deal with it. And as you well know, right, data quality in survey research has become a huge problem. In some cases, you have to throw away 20-30% of the data. Well, if you're now already dealing with hard to reach audiences and finally you got a sample of like 400-500, and now I have to throw away 20-30%. You know, now I'm cutting it really, you know, close, right? And so to have some alternatives available, like SMOT and like ChatGPT, can really be, I think, a lifesaver in terms of, like, you know, getting a good enough read on your, you know, on your audience.
Yeah, that, it's such an interesting application of shoring up sample frames. The first company I started is called Decipher, which is a survey platform. And one of the things that I built, this goes back in like 2007, it was a bot, and it would complete the surveys using random, you know, picking a random set of answers. Obviously, it was complying with different like survey question constructs. So for example, you might have a question like, you know, pick which of these are your favorite three, in which case it would only pick three of those answer choices, right? But anyway, so it would just do a random assignment for each, or answer for each question. But we would use this bot to proof our surveys, and we would build out, you know, tables or banner points for each logic point to make sure that our questions had the right coverage. In other words, you had the right people answering the right question.
Yeah.
So put very simply, if you had, let's say you had a question that was just males ages 18 to 34, and you had 100 of them answer that, you know, that was the requirement for a specific question, then, you know, and you had 100 that would qualify, then you would see that you had 100 there. So anyway, you would just have this random assignment there is what I'm trying to say. I'm wondering if there's been any like comparison between data like that that's randomly generated, but intuitive, you know, it makes sense versus SMOTE.
Now SMOTE is I guess it's a little bit different, although there is a random component in it. So maybe I can best illustrate it with an example. So let's say that you have a situation where you are the client, you know, you represent the client brand, and, you know, and you have a pretty solid market share, but now there's a new competitor, you know, emerging, but the competitor is still very small. You know, maybe it has 1-2% market share, you know, versus you know, your brand has like maybe 30-40% market share, right? And so now you do this survey, but because this is an emerging competitor, you know, not many people know about it, not many people are using it, and maybe also not many people are preferring it, right? So let's say that out of every 10 people, only one person prefers the emerging brand, and all the other 9 ones, you know, they prefer the client brand. And both brands are being evaluated on, let's say, a number of brand attributes. And now I'm developing a predictive model because I want to predict, you know, who is preferring, you know, my client brand and who's preferring the competing brand, and using those brand attributes, right? Because I want to see what's driving that preference. Now, what's going to happen is that predictive model, which is a binary, you know, regression model, it's a logistic model. What's going to happen is that model is just going to predict that everybody prefers a client brand, because if it does that, it will achieve a 90% hit rate, which is very good. And people, if you look at it at, you know, if you look at that result superficially, you might say like, oh, we have a great model. But actually, you don't have a great model because you didn't predict at all the competing brand, and there is really no information. Oftentimes, you know, the brand attributes are all non-significant because the model didn't really need that information. It could just make that 90, it could get to that 90% by just predicting that everybody prefers the client brand. So that's not interesting, right? So now what I do is I take 2 random respondents. One prefers the client brand and one prefers the emerging brand. And I pick and I create a new respondent that lies kind of like between that client brand's respondent and the competing brand's respondent. And we'll do that in a specific way. And there is a random component to it. I can't describe the whole procedure here because it's a little bit more complicated. But that's the idea. And I do that and I assign that person, you know, that new person will, you know, hypothetically will be preferring the competing brand. It's a synthetic data point. This respondent does not really exist. I created it, right? But I assign it now to the competing brand group. And I keep doing that until that competing brand group becomes almost as big as the number of people who prefer, you know, the client brand. So now I have a new sample in which the number of synthetic respondents are being added, and 50% prefers the client brand and 50% prefers the competing brand. So now the model cannot make an easy decision anymore. You know, it has to use the information from those brand attributes. And if you do that, and I've done this quite a few times, what you will see is that your model goes up dramatically. It will achieve still a 90% or more hit rate, but now you have significant brand attribute drivers, and you will actually predict who is preferring the competing brand, which is what you want, because you want to know why people are preferring that competing brand. And so that's kind of like how that methodology works. It is a method that, as far as I can tell, is not super well known in marketing research, but it is a completely standard method in data science.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because what you're basically talking about is this hierarchy or priority, right? And so the first set of priority from the data is brand preference. And then the second is why.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, that's correct.
It's fascinating. And I'd love to get my hands on some white papers discussing this. It is interesting to see how data science is starting to fit into market research and more, which is really, you know, I think of ourselves as like practical statisticians on the quantitative side. But whereas data science is approaching it really from a very different, obviously statistics, but you know, yeah. a very different point of view and dealing with completely different types of data. I mean, they could be well formed,
but
still it's, you know, it is very different. So it is an interesting sort of opportunity for us to be able to have this convergence.
Yeah, and by the way, you're touching on a slightly different topic now, Jamin, but maybe I can just quickly throw that in if it's of interest.
Yeah.
You know, you and me, we probably grew up at statistic, you know, learning statistics. At least I did, you know, in my studies, there was statistic. There was also what they called nonlinear multivariate analysis, but it was still very much in, you know, in the statistical fashion, if you will. But the last 20 years, the last 25 years, yeah, machine learning and data science has emerged. And there is actually a very interesting paper by a academic, his name is Leo Bryman, and the paper is called Two Cultures, and he describes the differences between the statistical culture and the machine learning culture, and he gives examples of where one works and the other one doesn't, and vice versa. And it is super interesting because there are applications and situations where you just cannot apply the standard statistical approach because it doesn't work. And, you know, but then if you use the data science techniques, like decision trees, random forest, SMOTE, you know, you can demonstrate that, you know, that in those specific situations, those techniques work very well. So for anybody who's interested in data analysis, I can highly recommend that paper.
That's so interesting. Yeah, it's a really neat time. I heard an analogy on Saturday of this week, and for reference, today is July 26, 2023, so just a few days ago. AI for us right now, like the application of AI, is very analogous to what the 1400 baud modem was back in the day. The implication being that we're just at the cusp, like we're just entering, we're walking through a new door, or we're crossing a threshold, might be a better way of saying it, into this new world. We have to start questioning how we do things and the methodologies, the sample frames, the analytics plans that we write, and not just keep copying and pasting from the last, you know, five research projects, just to kind of like generate the next one.
I would imagine that it would require, you know, adopting some new skill sets by marketing researchers. Of course, you can, like if you take ChatGPT, you can apply it in, you know, in a fairly straightforward manner. You just ask it questions and you get answers. You know, you can say like, hey, write me a brief for a qualitative research project, or, you know, develop an initial draft of the survey. I think those applications are fairly straightforward and not super difficult, you know, to do. But if you get into the more, I would say, more complex and complicated applications, like, you know, generating, you know, real respondent data from ChatGPT, or for example, if you want to use it as a methodology to analyzing text data, which you can also do, by the way, then I think you do need some additional skills to, you know, to actually do that in a responsible and, you know, and valid way, right? And then you also, by the way, will start to see that these methodologies, even though they're very advanced, they are not perfect. You know, for example, if you, let's say that you have 20,000-30,000 unstructured responses, and I want to analyze that with a large language model like ChatGPT or a model called BERT, which is a similar model to ChatGPT, you get maybe an accuracy of maybe 70-75%, and you have to do definitely some manual tweaking to get it to a level that, you know, that is going to be actually acceptable, you know, for delivery to a client, right? So, and this is something that I don't think many people really know or realize. And so.
You touched on something, an important thing for us to talk about, and that is the ability to analyze open ends or unstructured data. One of the concerns around that with ChatGPT is security of the actual data. How are you addressing that?
That's a really good question, Jamin. The way that I address it is that I'm using a different model than ChatGPT for analysis of open-ended responses. I have used ChatGPT as well, but I have done it explicitly with the approval of the client. If there is really a concern of security and also confidentiality, right, which in some cases there is, then you can use a model like the BERT model, and that doesn't really, you know, that's kind of like an off-the-shelf version of the ChatGPT model. You actually run it yourself. It is pre-trained, but it doesn't, you know, the data doesn't go back to, you know, to the bigger repository of data from which, you know, ChatGPT can draw, right?
So, you know, ChatGPT is such a large language model that it's going to derive a hypothesis no matter what your question is. In other words, it thinks it has enough data. At least I haven't been able to get it to the point where it's like, I have insufficient data. So what I'm wondering is, with the BERT model, are you able to limit the source of its training for its language model?
Yes. Yeah, the BERT model is a smaller model. I don't have the numbers exactly. I think ChatGPT is based on 350 billion parameters, and I think the BERT model, it may be 100 million. So it's an order of magnitude smaller. It runs also faster, and you can actually run it on your machine. I don't know exactly how they compare. I would have to look that up, Jim, and how they compare in terms of pre-training. And even with the BERT model, there are also different, you know, all these things are like, it's not one technique, right? All of these things are kind of like a class of techniques. You know, there are many different varieties of the BERT model, and there are different varieties of ChatGPT as well. But at a high level, that's how I would characterize it. One is big and is run on, you know, and developed on billions of parameters. The other one is a little bit smaller, a little bit more efficient, can run a little bit faster, and also is trained on a smaller pre-trained data set.
Yeah,
that's how I would describe it. BERT model we have used a lot, and ChatGPT we have used a few times for the analysis of data. In both cases, for both BERT and for ChatGPT, if you let it loose on an actual data set, right, with open-ended responses, they both do a really good job. I mean, it is impressive what they do. But I also want people to understand that computers are not people, right? They don't really understand what's going on. They just are really smart in looking at similarities, right? And in predicting what the next word or what the next comment would be, right? And therefore they can then say like, well, this person says this, but this person said that, but they're going to say this. And so, therefore they're similar and, you know, they maybe fall in the same category. They're really good at that. What they really can't do is look at the meaning of something, because people can say things in different ways and mean exactly the same thing.
Yeah,
and the computer won't pick up on that. It has to have similarity in terms of the words, and that's still an amazing capability, by the way. Because if I can do that on 20,000 to 100,000 people, and I can do it really quickly, that is not something that I as a human being can do. But in order to get intelligent insights from a data set, it's always my recommendation to mix it with a qualitative human being coding of the data, even if it's partial. To find out kind of like where the nuance meanings are, and then you can feed that as a pre-code, as a set of pre-codes to the BERT model or to ChatGPT, and those models can then use that human insight to get a better result of the analysis.
This is a really important point that you're making. I was doing the onboarding for Google's AI training course that they've released. I believe it was 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago now, and in the opening, like whatever, a few pages, the head of product said something to the effect of, it has never been more important for us to layer in qualitative research because we need to get to the why and the humanization component of, you know, whatever the outcomes are of your analysis. They need to connect with your audience so that it can create a bigger lever of change in the organization. So it is kind of an interesting sort of like, we're leaning into statistics or AI in a new, very powerful way. But at the same time, we're being met with this need to be able to create good human stories that can move customers. And so, you know, we're not by any means, to your point, like able to just check out and say, okay, the machine's done it, I can move on. In every way, in the same way you and I would do like factorial analysis, something relatively simple, we're still going to probably move things around. Right? And there is this art and science, and the art and science isn't certainly going away with ChatGPT.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Everyone, our guest today has been Marco Vriens, founder and CEO of Quantum. He's also the author of From Data to Decision and The Business of Marketing Research. Marco, thank you for joining me on the Happy Market Research Podcast.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Everyone else, I hope you have a fantastic rest of your day.